Whatever you may think of the Golden Globes, their voters hit a bullseye when they gave a special award to Norman Lear, the youngest 98-year-old in Hollywood. He could easily coast along on his many accomplishments as a writer, producer, director, and political activist. Instead, he is engaged in new projects on a daily basis. He also wrote a candid, entertaining autobiography called Even This I Get to Experience. Jesse and I were privileged to spend an hour with him as he was just settling into his new office suite on the Sony Pictures lot 2.5 years ago. He gave birth to such TV series as All in the Family, Maude, and The Jeffersons, and was then busily involved in a reboot of One Day at a Time. He's worked in television since 1950, but no one seems to talk to him about the movies he wrote, produced, and/or directed, like Cold Turkey, or those for which he was a midwife, like The Princess Bride. We relished spending time with this highly amusing, soft-spoken giant, even when he fielded a cell phone call from a political fundraiser in the middle of our interview. Enjoy.
Hi, guys. We are so excited to tell you about our sponsor today. Maltanon Movies is being brought to you by Legion M, and it's the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. We love working with them. They are some of the nicest people, and they do lots of really cool things like fan meetups, events all over the country. They really make it fun for anybody who's a part of the Legion.
You can actually own a piece of a movie, and it doesn't cost a fortune to do it. Find out more at www.legionm.com. Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And we are sitting here today with, I'm sorry, I have to call you a living legend.
prolific.
So long as it's living.
Prolific, I think, yeah.
Anyway, this is Mr. Norman Lear we are sitting with. Welcome.
Welcome, Mr. Leonard Maltin.
Thank you, sir. You made a remark. I saw you speak at the AFI award luncheon a couple of years ago, and you said that when you were in your 80s, people were respectful and kind, you know, and polite. But as soon as you turned 90, they became very deferential.
Yes. I would start to get applause for standing. Crossing a room was an ovation.
Well, you've earned all that.
Well, thank you. But this was just having lived that long.
Yeah. Well, there's something to that, too.
Oh, there's a lot. There's 6 more years of that now.
Do you have good genetics?
I wouldn't say so, but the fact that my dad passed in his 50s, I think, in his late 50s. My mom lived into her early 90s.
Well, so maybe there's something there.
Maybe there's something there. Who knows? He knows. She knows. It knows.
That's right. That's right. Somebody knows. Somebody outside of our realm.
Yes.
Now, the obvious thing to do would be to come here to your lovely new office, and you just moved in to this lovely
Sony lot. Mm-hmm. The Sony studio lot. It's a glorious office. Tony Vinciquerra, who's the man who runs the lot now, mm-hmm. was in this office and moved out. I don't think he moved out to make space for me, mm-hmm. but they did accord me the pleasure of having his office, ex-office, within days or a few weeks of his having mm-hmm. left it.
Well, it's one of the most beautiful views I've ever seen. It is gorgeous up here. And you've got so many wonderful pieces of art and photos and memories. It's incredible.
A lot of memories. I have 6 kids, and it's largely my wives and kids.
That's the next show for you, right? Wives and
wives
kids.
Wives and kids. That's a good title.
Got a couple of each. But that's the thing. It's amazing and a bit overwhelming to look at everything you've done. Because, like, I love Andy Williams. I love Andy Williams.
I adored him.
To see that you worked with him. All of the different musical acts that you worked with. That's the thing. It's not just TV. It's TV and it's film and it's music. You've done so much, and with the best of the best. It is overwhelming to look through all of it. I can't imagine. And of course, we always say it's not history while you're living it. So this is your life.
You're making history while you're living it.
Yeah. Exactly. As you are
I'm careful to say we're all doing that. Everybody who hears my voice at this moment is making history mm-hmm. by living it.
That's right.
People don't pay enough attention to the importance of their lives.
And that's just it, is that because you don't realize it's going to be history someday, you just live it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't necessarily archive it or shepherd it along in any special way. You just have to show up at your job in the morning or.
Yeah, I think of it this way. There are two little words, small words, we don't pay enough attention to, over and next. When something is over, it's over. We're on to next. But if there was a hammock in the middle of those two words, that would be the best definition I know of living in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So we are living in this moment.
Mm.
And it took every split second of our lives to get here.
Yeah.
And everybody who is listening to the sound of my voice now, it took every split second of their lives to hear me finish this sentence. That's amazing when you think of it that
way. It is. It absolutely is.
Now, you would be entitled to rest on your laurels, literally and figuratively. You have many awards, many honors, and to...
Well, to finish, what you were saying is you read in an article that I think they asked you something along the lines of what do you enjoy about working? Why do you keep working? What excites you? And you said, I like to have a reason to get out of bed every day.
Mm-hmm.
I like to have a purpose.
Yeah, I like to get up to do something.
Yeah.
And one of the things you're doing right now is what they call a reboot of your much-loved sitcom of decades ago called One Day at a Time.
Right.
And the new version is just delightful. Very well cast, I thought.
Well, it's the Latin version of what we did so many years ago.
Yeah,
with Rita Moreno, who is just one of the great
treasures
of theater and film and television. She's an EGOT, you know.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The Emmy, the
Grammy,
the Grammy,
Oscar, and a Tony.
Oscar, yeah.
There are not a lot of EGOTs in the world. It's a big deal.
And she's just a great woman.
Yeah.
And Justina Machado, her junior by a good many years, mm-hmm. but just the greatest professional.
Oh, she's sharp. She's really good.
Mm-hmm.
And irresistibly likable.
Yes. That's good. Irresistibly likable is mm-hmm. a great description of mm-hmm. her.
So mazel tov, as we say in the old country.
Yes.
Thank you.
And may it continue as long as you want it to. But I thought just to be different, or to be ornery, I don't know which, we would start by not asking you about your illustrious...
Haven't we started?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
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 This happened.
We would start...
He meant start by going through the career.
Start this
but
new phase.
That's right. Yes. But I will say, so the only thing I would ask is people who learn about you, people who see all of the work that you've done, please just... go into just a little bit of how it all started for you. Where are you from? Where did you grow up?
I was born in New Haven, Connecticut, 96, soon to be 97, July, years ago. Moved from there to, we lived in Massachusetts for a little while. I was 9 years old, living in Chelsea, Mass, when my father was arrested. It's a hallmark of my life because he went to prison for 3 years. And I can see the window in the bed, the window behind the bed where I used to lean on my elbows and look out the window from my bed, watching older kids play in the late spring, early evening of late spring, so 7:30, 8 o'clock or whatever it is, I had to get to bed. I'm watching kids out there. It was in that house my dad was taken. I learned, it's all great hallmarks of my life because I ran into Father Coughlin on radio, who was a... let's find out who's on my telephone.
Yes. I hear
in my pocket. And I have told my daughters that I would always be there for them. Hello? It is. Who's this? You're a finance executive? What? Oh, for the Democratic Party. Oh, and so you guessed that I was a Democrat? I'm certainly supportive of veterans. I am a veteran. Yeah. Well, here I wanted to tell you, Jeff, that I'm in the middle of an interview, and you are now part of this interview. If they choose to keep it, they could cut it, of course. Okay. But so call again, or if you don't call again, I'm not sure I'll miss it. Okay. Good luck to you.
That is the most polite turndown to a solicitor that I think I've ever heard.
Well, we're doing our best. We're in a podcast. We got to look good.
That's right.
So you remember staring out the window.
Watching other kids play, and that's the house where you remember your father was taken from you.
Yeah. So I heard Father Coughlin on the radio.
Right.
I learned because my parents were Jewish, I was Jewish. They weren't very religious, so I hadn't paid a lot of attention to it until I learned there were people who hated it.
Yeah. And Father Coughlin, we should explain, was a frighteningly successful radio personality and evangelist who preached hate. Does that sum it up right?
No, he preached hate. He did. This is a really good time to remember that because it's abroad in the land again. This is a difficult time. That was a difficult time in the Father Coughlin sense. But it leads me to a thought that I love talking about. What sustained me as a kid were the civics classes I was taking in a public school. I didn't go to a private school. I couldn't afford that. I was going to a public school, but they taught civics. So I, at 9 years of age, understood very well and very clearly that I lived in a country that said no to that, that went out of its way. It was born saying, this is wrong. Anti-Semitism, Catholicism, black, white, all of that, you know. I'm better than you are. You're not worthy of me. Wrong in this country of ours. So, oh, God, that was so sustaining for me. And I never, ever forgot what my America's all about, what your America is all about.
Which is why you started People for the American Way some decades later.
For the same reason.
Yeah.
I was deeply concerned about a father, Pat Robertson here and a Jerry Falwell there.
Mm-hmm.
They were, it's amazing because it's not happening as much now, but they were booming on radio and television and threatening everything that I felt threatened at when I was a kid. So that's how People for the American Way was born. What can I do about it? I can collect people who felt the same way.
Yeah, yeah.
And what got you into writing or wanting to do some of what you've done? Were you an artistic person?
Well, I was a kid of the Depression, so I had one uncle, my father's brother Jack, who was the only guy who ever flicked me a quarter. So he was my hero. He was the only I'm thinking about it as I talk about it, the only person I wanted to be. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be an uncle who could flick a quarter because there was no other grand act in the life of my family. But an uncle flipping me a quarter to a nephew was just great. And I wanted to be that uncle. He was a press agent, so I wanted to be a press agent. I understood, coming out of the Army, the Air Force, if I wanted to be a press agent, I should be in New York or Los Angeles, or Chicago, maybe. Mm-hmm. And so I started in New York as a press agent, got a lovely job as a press agent, $40 a week. I was taken down to $35 as punishment for having written this line for Dorothy Kilgallen, and she printed it and then blamed me if she printed it. But mm-hmm. We represented a show. Press agents represented the shows and got them into the, you know, the idea was to get them mentioned in the columns.
To get
there were lots of columns.
To get Walter ink, Winchell, as they said in those days.
Walter Winchell, Dorothy Kilgallen, Leonard Lyons, Stanton Walker, they were all mm-hmm. columnists in newspapers then. I wrote for Dorothy Kilgallen, and she printed. We represented a show called, a Broadway show called Are You With It? And one, it was a review. And one of the acts in the review was Buster Shaver and his midgets. And the lead midget was named Olive. So I wrote, Dorothy again printed, Buster Shaver seen shopping Fifth Avenue with Olive. He on foot, she on a St. Bernard. And she printed it. Somebody must have said, Dorothy, what the hell? How could you print that crap? She called the George Ross I worked for and said, you got to fire that kid.
Oh, my God.
So he fired me, and I pleaded. And he took me down from $40 to $35.
Wow.
All for a St. Bernard.
Yeah. All for a St. Bernard.
Yeah, that was a costly wisecrack. Now, since you lived that life, at least for a little while, how do you relate to the film Sweet Smell of Success, Ernest Lehman's?
I thought the world of Tony Curtis.
Yeah.
And I knew Ernest Lehman and I became great friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so I love that. I love that film.
Mm-hmm. So do I, and so do many other people.
There's nobody else that's ever mentioned it to me besides you. I love
really?
I love it that we're talking about that.
Oh, good.
Sweet Smell of Success.
Great yeah. film.
Well, those columnists in those days, this all sounds...
Oh, my God, they had power.
Ancient days.
Yeah.
They most of them were syndicated as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't only in New York.
No.
But they wielded great power.
Well, coming out here, there was a Hedda Hopper.
Right.
Yep.
And for a little while, Luella Parsons.
Mm-hmm.
Little while in my life.
Right.
Out here, she was around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I always think about
But they
Army.
Were institutions.
Yeah.
Did you ever read Army Archer?
Oh, yes.
He was.
We were great friends.
That was a big thing for my mom, that he mentioned my bat mitzvah in his column.
Oh, yes.
That my mom said, this has to, if we get this, then we've made it in life, you know, to be in one of Archie's columns, Army's columns.
Army
sorry.
Archer.
So you're not the only one, well, like Ernie Lehman, you're not the only one to have... started out professionally as a press agent and moved on to other forms of writing.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen for you?
How did it happen? I'm trying to remember. My first film, I think, was he can make trims here,
oh, yes,
so
yes.
I don't have to be heard ahing.
Mm-hmm. The first film I have that you have credit on is a
Cold Turkey?
No,
Divorce American Style.
No, earlier than that, even.
Right. You've got Scared Stiff.
Scared Stiff.
Scared Stiff.
And then Come Blow Your Horn.
Yeah. No, I'd forgotten about that. We worked for...
You've done a lot.
We kind of brought Martin and Lewis into television. We wrote their very first 2 years of television.
Wow. On the Colgate Comedy Hour.
Colgate Comedy Hour, mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, really? Before that, oh, my God, I forgot all about this.
It's okay.
Jack Haley was on television in a show called The Ford, after the automobile, The Ford Star Review. Mm-hmm. And we did a piece of material for Danny Thomas, this nightclub material. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I remember what it was. He used to tell the longest jokes. But you may have a note that tells me what it was. I don't know.
No, I don't. I'm sorry, I don't. Well, it wasn't the Jack story. He'd already gone to town on that.
That's how we found him, with the Jack story. But he told these long stories, got a lot of laughs telling a story for 5 minutes, and then came the punchline, or 10 minutes. But we wrote a piece for him, which he did at Ciro's one night, and he was asked the next morning who wrote that. David Susskind was the one who asked him. He was then a press agent. And the next morning we got a telephone call. Could we be in New York by Thursday or something? Within a couple of days to write the Jack Haley. Jack Haley was coming on television. Mm-hmm. We were offered the job of writing the Jack Haley Ford Star Review.
That's you and your partner, Ed Simmons.
Ed Simmons. Mm-hmm. So Eddie and I wrote 2 sketches for that very first show. Dean and Jerry, Martin and Lewis, were coming on television. He saw that first sketch and said, he didn't know anything about who was writing what anywhere. And so he didn't know that this was our first job.
Is this Jerry now?
We were just old-timers who had written this show.
Right.
And Jerry Lewis asked for those guys. It was MCA, the same company that handled Jack Haley, that handled it. So it was an easy switch to take us off the Haley show and put us on Martin and Lewis. And we wrote the first Dean and Jerry. Hmm.
Incredible.
Oh my God,
and many to follow.
And a few to follow, yeah.
Well, that's part of, I know your TV work, and I knew a lot of your film work, but I didn't realize how many of these sorts of acts that you had worked with. The fact that you've got people like Danny Kaye and Bobby Darin, you know,
Bobby Darin, we were great friends.
But that is part of what knocks me out, is the span of people. So many incredible people.
Because in this conversation we can talk about anything.
Absolutely.
I'm reminded, thinking of Bobby Darin, he was very close to Bobby Kennedy. Mm-hmm. And I knew Kennedy well, too, and I certainly knew him well enough to care a great deal for who he was and what he represented in our culture. And he was killed here in the, I forget which hotel.
The Ambassador.
The Ambassador. Been the Ambassador, yes. And for I don't know how many nights, Bobby Darin came over every night for 6 nights, 7 nights or something. And we, you know, for the first few nights, we just wept together. He had far more to weep about because he was really close. And then, as a matter of fact, he built an act around him sitting to the front of a stage, but sitting in a chair, which he had never done before, and just playing songs that touched the heart, talking about Kennedy a little, and then... What he was talking about is his love of Kennedy and the meaning of that loss to the country. And then the music that followed was all of that mood. And I mean, he didn't do well. He had to stop and go back to doing what he was doing again. But it was so memorable to me because it was just so hard for him to do that.
How did you meet up with your longtime partner, Bud Yorkin?
Bud Yorkin, when I was doing the Martin Lewis shows, we started in New York. The very first Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis, Colgate Comedy Hour were in New York. And the three stage managers were Jack Smyth, who was a big name then, John Rich.
I know the last one, Arthur Penn.
Arthur Penn and Bud Yorkin. And Bud Yorkin. Arthur Penn, yes, who became a great, great director. And one night we were there was a party at but oh the party was re, the reason was Pat Weaver, who ran NBC, announced that the comedies were going to move to California, and we had a party at Bud Yorkin's, and Pat Weaver was there. I remember we were standing around the piano. See how much of this I can remember. And we wrote this song, like five of us, with Arthur Penn, Bud Yorkin, Pat, myself. I don't know, somebody else. And we wrote, when the transcontinental coaxial cable is laid, it's laid. When the transcontinental coaxial table is laid, we're made. We'll be there with our kinfolks. You'll hear those cucamonga jokes coming to you from Hollywood and Vine Street. That's as much as I can.
That's plenty.
That's great.
That's great.
We'll be on the run to the land of sun and swimming pools. The dramatic shows will be static shows if they stay. Those fools, this part I love. Horchichonia, it's California. We'll ride the super chief when the transcontinental coaxial cable is made.
Oh,
is
my
laid.
God. Now to get all right for I'm your footnote a slave here. The coaxial cable, before there was a coaxial cable, TV shows were live. There was no such thing as videotape,
right?
And when they were broadcast from New York, they could only reach halfway across the country, and so the West Coast got what was called a kinescope, which was a 16-millimeter film shot right off a monitor. And so necessarily the quality was not that great. And everything changed when they...
When the coaxial cable was laid.
Yeah.
Oh, the word kinescope was so... It's a big part of our lives.
We're grateful that we have some of them now.
Yeah.
You know, it's the only thing, only record of those shows. My God. So you met Bud on that show, on the Colgate show.
So, yes, I met him. And then when the comedies moved west, we moved west together. He could afford a house on one side of, hills or, I don't remember. But we lived in the valley, in other words.
Right.
And Bud lived in Beverly Hills.
Yes, the other side of the hill.
Yeah,
yes.
The other side of the hill. And then Simmons and I were out of work for a long time. Maybe a year would have been a long time. And we could ill afford that. And Bud was doing the Tennessee Ernie Ford show. He had been offered producing. And he offered us a job for much less money than we made for Martin and Lewis. And Simmons thought it was a big mistake to take it. And I had to take it. And so that was how we went in different directions. I took that job. And it was, you know, a start all over again kind of situation.
Sure. Bless your little pea-picking heart. Why do I remember
that
stuff
was Ernie
like that?
Ford. Bless your little pea-picking
heart. Why do I remember these things, Jesse?
Because these are the important things.
I know. And then television yielded many opportunities.
Yes.
And then in the decades to follow, golden opportunities.
Yeah.
With all of the shows that people know and remember, All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Good Times, The Jeffersons, One Day at a Time, Mary Hartman.
Oh, Mary Hartman.
Fernwood Tonight, which later became America Tonight, one of my all-time favorite shows, all time.
Trying to recast Fernwood Tonight right now.
Yeah.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, that's...
There's a lot of interest in doing it again.
Oh, that's
great.
We
love Fred Willard. We love Fred.
I adore him, too. And Martin Mull.
Oh, yeah, and that's...
What a great team.
Oh.
What a great team. So just to twist the conversation a little bit, what led to you and Bud working on a feature of Neil Simon's play, Come Blow Your Horn? How did that come about? There was a big separation between movie people and TV people in those days.
Well, you know, Danny and Doc, Neil Simon at the beginning of his career was known as Doc Simon.
Mm-hmm.
And his brother Danny was older, and he was the senior guy.
Mm-hmm.
Bud Yorkin and I were doing the Martha Ray Show again in New York. And we hired Danny and Doc to work with us.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew Doc Simon before he became Neil. And after he became Neil, he wrote Come Blow Your Horn. Mm-hmm. It was called something else at the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
We made the film Come Blow Your Horn from his play. So we bought the film rights. Paramount paid for them, but we were in business with Paramount. We bought the film rights, and if we made the picture, we had the rights to his two next plays.
Oh, my.
And his two next plays were...
Barefoot in the Park?
Barefoot in the Park with
Robert Redford.
With Robert Redford and Elizabeth Ashley.
Mm-hmm.
And the next one was the two guys,
the odd couple.
Yeah. It is Come Blow Your Horn.
Come Blow Your Horn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it was called something else.
It's saying that it was the play, that was the play as well.
Enter Laughing. No, that was Carl Reiner's play.
Yeah.
See, you know too many good people. That's the problem.
Yeah.
You've got a laundry list of legends.
It's never been a problem.
Nope.
So Paramount had no hesitation hiring a couple of TV guys to do a feature length film.
Yeah, we had the rights. We Bud and I got on a plane to go to New York and then take a car to outside of
New Haven.
No, Pennsylvania. Outside of Philadelphia,
mm-hmm.
to see Barefoot in the Park, mm-hmm. with Redford and Ashley. On the way in the plane, on flying east. My friend, John Henry Falk, had just written the book about his, he was a country comic who got into trouble and was blacklisted. And he wrote a book about the blacklist, which we were reading on the plane going east. We wrote a letter to Paramount saying we thought that Neil's play would be a big hit, would go to Broadway, it'd be a big hit, it'd be 3 years before the film was made, and why couldn't we make the film of the John Henry Falk book first? The way the letter was written, it could be misinterpreted.
Hmm.
And whoever was running, I can't remember, the studio at the time, deliberately misinterpreted. And we found ourselves out of work in terms of, well, okay, go ahead and do your thing. And when you come back, we'll do... Come Blow Your Horn.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that. We did Come Blow Your Horn.
And then you wound up producing several films. where Bud was the director.
Yeah.
And you were the producer. Never Too Late. Start the Revolution Without Me, which I love.
Oh, that was great.
I love that film.
Yeah.
And were you there for the whole shoot? And where was that shot?
It was shot in France.
Mm-hmm.
It was all shot in France, and I was there for a good deal of it. You know, when I had the idea, this was an original. When I had the idea, this was two twins who were born, two sets of twins were born, and they got mixed in the same crazy fashion, mm-hmm. from the same doctor. And when I first had the idea, I wanted to do it with the Kennedys.
Mm.
So there were two sets of Kennedys that were mixed up. And then had the idea, I forget who got credit. There were two good, wonderful guys who got credit for the screenplay, as they should have. But I worked very closely with them. And then we decided to make it what it was. God, I love that film.
Inspired casting, Gene Wilder and Donald Sutherland.
Gene Wilder and Donald Sutherland, yeah.
Just great. Just great. And The Thief Who Came to Dinner and others along the line here. But then you wrote and produced and got an Oscar nomination for writing Divorce American Style.
Yes.
Now, I remember that when it came out, and I remember what a gutsy move it was to take America's sweethearts, essentially, Dick Van Dyke and Debbie Reynolds, and cast them in a dramatic comedy, you might call it,
mm-hmm.
about divorce. And a realistic look at divorce. And you pulled it off.
I love that film.
Yeah. No. I was just wondering. I think it's underrated, and I think it deserves to be seen more nowadays.
I hope somebody's listening that who can make that happen. I agree with you.
Mm-hmm.
It was about. It was a real serious look at divorce mm-hmm. in our time.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to work at all to persuade either of your stars to do this? A sort of change of pace?
I don't recall mm-hmm. having to work hard to do it. I think they wished to do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then you did, you were...
And then I loved the other guy in Divorce American Style.
Jason Robards?
Jason Robards.
Ah, well.
Junior.
Yes.
Yeah.
And a great part for Shelley Berman.
And a great part for Shelley Berman, the lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, you and Dick Van Dyke got along because you then teamed up again for Cold Turkey,
mm-hmm.
which, correct me if I'm wrong, I think is the only feature film you ever directed.
Yes.
As well as writing and producing. What inspired it?
You know what really inspired it was my friendship with, it was Richard Brooks who said to me, direct the film.
Mm.
Yeah.
Were you nervous at all?
And I was so nervous I went to him.
Mm.
And he said, get yourself the best cinematographer you can get and know you're in good hands and direct the film. And he also said this is... He also said, nobody gets closer to playing God than a director on location. And I remember that in Iowa, making Cold Turkey, because the little town you were in, everybody was, I mean, you were more important than the mayor mm-hmm. for the 4 weeks you were there.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole town was hanging on your every word, in a sense. Oh, God, such pictures come to mind, you know, as I think about that and those words, Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a movie I love called State in Maine. That's David Mamet.
Yes.
And it's all about the film crew shows up to this small town and takes over.
Yes, I love that film.
It's so good. It's so good.
So, and was it a satisfying experience then?
Oh, totally. Mm-hmm. Totally. But for what reason, I don't know. It was an experience I cared about repeating.
Mm-hmm.
I had it once and it was enough.
It fulfilled your ego.
Or something. or it met his promise.
Mm-hmm. Bob and Ray are in your film. For which I thank
for
you.
For which I was as proud of that as anything I ever did. That I brought Bob and Ray to a wider audience.
Oh.
I didn't realize who his son was and now granddaughter, and the fact that they are one of the only families with three generations that were on SNL.
Who's
Chris Elliott, who made his own reputation.
Oh, yeah.
His son, and then daughter, comedian. Abby Elliott. So they
I
are
don't
because
know about her.
She's a wonderful young actress.
Yes.
But we got to speak to them about that a little bit. My dad's always been a huge Bob and Ray fan, so he brought it up to Chris.
Right.
So it's like, wait a minute, they were on SNL very early. So that's three generations.
You know, I love that I did that because I just so admired them.
Mm.
I remember them on radio before I was in the business.
Sure. Mm.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right, because you were in New England and they were on Boston local radio.
Yeah, that's where I first learned of them.
Mm-hmm.
What did I want to mention about... I saw Cold Turkey. Somebody in Pasadena who has a film club called me, it might be 2 years ago now, and said he wanted to run Cold Turkey and asked me if I could come out and talk about it and so forth. So I did. And I hadn't seen Cold Turkey for 20 years or something. And I realized only a couple of years ago how savage it was.
Mm.
I mean, it was a comedy, and it played like a comedy.
Oh, but it was a satire.
But it was a savage satire.
Yeah.
And I guess the reason I thought about it and in those terms was it's exactly the way I was feeling and am feeling about our culture now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Angry.
So angry.
Yeah. The film was not a great hit. It was a critical success. But then you know what George S. Kaufman said about satire. It's what closes on Saturday night.
Yeah.
So, but it was a Pyrrhic victory because you made a good movie. And that stands. What was your involvement with The Princess Bride?
The Princess Bride, I'm proud to say, was... my total involvement was made it possible for it to be made.
Mm-hmm.
I had nothing to do with it creatively, not from a writing standpoint or a casting standpoint or any standpoint. It was 100% Rob Reiner.
Mm-hmm.
But for some crazy, now and again stupid reason, nobody wanted to make it.
Mm.
And I... it was doing very well off of whatever, All in the Family or all of that stuff. And I guaranteed it's being made, you know. So when it was in production for a couple of weeks, I got a phone call. It was a Sunday morning, and he had read the script. Or maybe there was some film to see, too. I think there was a few weeks of film and the script. And he called me on a Sunday morning and said, we're doing this. And I was the one who was guaranteeing its budget.
Yeah. You were the collateral.
I was the collateral.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy, Irish name, Warner Brothers... most likable guy, he called and said he wanted, we're going to do this.
Not too many Irish names at Warner Brothers.
I was going to say Jack O. No. Warner.
Well, then that turned out extremely well.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you're also an executive producer on Fried Green Tomatoes.
And the same story there. Mm-hmm. I helped to make that possible. And
John Avnet.
John Avnet, from a creative standpoint, totally. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, he is hoping to make it again.
Oh, yeah?
And the funding exists from several sources. And I hope he... what's her name? Fanny Flagg.
Fanny Flagg.
Also wants to make it.
Mm-hmm.
But
why not? I skipped over one film I need to ask you about. The Night They Raided Minsky's.
That was one of the loves of my life. You know, I think every once in a while about writing another book.
Mm-hmm.
And,
write another book.
Yeah.
Let me convince you now. Write another book.
But the thing I think about that makes me think about wishing to write it is Burlesque.
Mm.
Because, I don't know, a year ago, I turned 95. But no, this was, I think, for my 90th. Anyway, my friends, some boyfriends, wanted to do a bachelor party for me. So they took me to a burlesque house where there was burlesque. So I looked at, we had a lovely dinner and saw us three strippers.
Now, this is New Age burlesque, as they call it.
I didn't know there was another term, New Age burlesque. But it was so far from burlesque, as I knew burlesque. When I went to Emerson College, the old Howard was the theater of record in Boston with burlesque. But they had great comics. Burlesque was about the comics more than the strippers.
Mm-hmm.
The strippers got the notoriety. The comics, the straight man and the comic is something I think about all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now, we have a comic in the White House who is basically in the role of the straight man who has the comics bumping into walls. The straight man knows everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he has the comics, bumping into walls is the best way I can narrow it down. And that's what the American people are doing now as the result of a straight man who feels like a comic. So it's a metaphor that I value very highly. I think about a great deal, and I loved burlesque because it said so much about who we were as a culture, and no wonder it's not understood and referred to and alive and well in our culture today.
And you were trying to capture that in The Night They Raided Minsky.
Yes, in The Night They Raided.
Well, and Jason Robards and Norman Wisdom are a wonderful duo.
Yes. I had Walter Matthau in that role. David Picker, one of the great studio heads, was running United Artists at the time. And David Picker and I... and Walter Matthau was playing the role. We're meeting in David's office. We had a great meeting. We laughed like hell. And Joel Grey was going to play the other role.
Mm-hmm.
And Walter Matthau and I left his office and said, "Why don't we walk home?" Walter said his doctor had told him to do a lot of walking. We walked all the way downtown to his home. I'm remembering this so well, feeling so great about it. Because the next morning, and so we had this long, wonderful walk, and Walter, and we became great friends that transcended what I'm about to tell you. The next morning, I get a call from David Picker that Walter Matthau was married to...
Carol.
Carol...
Saroyan.
Saroyan, yeah. And I get a call from David Picker that Carol had just gotten a call from Walter's mother, who was saying she's going to kill Carol. And Walter's mother, and Carol was already on a booked on a train to go to California, and Walter was getting on another train to go to California. And we lost him. We didn't have him for the film. Go forget that.
There's so many fascinating what ifs.
Oh yeah, that's
especially regarding casting.
Yes.
You know, where you can't picture anybody else.
What if it had been made with? Yeah.
But I like the film the way it is. And I took a class with Ralph Rosenblum.
Oh, yes.
Who,
the editor.
Many years ago, who you know, talked about the checkered history of the film in post-production.
In post-production, yes. Oh, wonder what his story was.
Yeah.
Our stories are not the same.
I'm sure of that.
I'm always fascinated by how pop culture works, in the sense that my dad and I were talking about some of the shows yesterday. We were going over, you know, the fact that there were multiple spinoffs and how interesting that was, and that they were huge successes. But something that I always find really amusing is Family Guy is a show that is always paying homage to this type of stuff. So I showed my dad this really funny little bit they did with Maude. And that amazes me that there are a lot of young people where if you say to them, have you ever seen Maude? They might say no, but they'll know the references. That's how deeply ingrained things are to pop culture. And that's the thing is you'll hear people singing the theme song for Good Times. You know, and they'll make jokes of temporary layoffs, good times. It becomes like a joke. People don't even necessarily know where the reference comes from. They just know the thing. And that is part of what's so wild about you being involved in all of these, that these are shows that have stuck. And whether it's TV Land or whatever it may be, they keep playing. So they're constantly referenced. That always say that that fascinates me, the way that pop culture works.
No more than it fascinates me.
Yeah. I mean,
I love it. It's a matter of fact, those shows, Good Times, The Jeffersons, and so forth, are resonating more in my life right now than they did 20 years ago when they were resonating also. Mm-hmm. But generationally, you know, how I love hearing it, because I remember feeling the same thing. So many people, black people, will talk to me about how they laughed with their parents at the Jeffersons and Good Times and so forth. I laughed with my father. Oh my God, how my father used to laugh. And I remember listening to radio with my dad and laughing at some shows, and Hilo Silver away from the Lone Ranger.
He's getting his Lone Ranger ring fixed right now, but he wears a Lone Ranger ring.
Is that right?
I do.
Yes.
Yeah.
My dad fought to get home by 7 o'clock to listen to the Lone Ranger on radio.
But see, that's the... We used to read, my dad would read the Lil Abner comics with me, and we had the thick books, and we'd go through, and that was part of how I learned how to read, was with Lil Abner.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about radio shows, we often talk about that. We love Jack Benny. There's lots of stuff like Suspense and those different, in the same way that TV show-wise, you'll hear a lot of women talk about Golden Girls. Mm-hmm. I watched that with my mother and my grandmother, so that show is attached to me. Mm. And it's exactly what you're saying. It's something like this comes up and people immediately go, oh my God, I remember sitting at home. I remember doing this. I remember being with them.
Laughing. Because it was part of the family bond.
Yeah.
And it helped forge a family bond for many people.
Well, a family, there's no greater, stronger bond than a family laughing together.
Yeah. That's right.
I agree.
Well, that's it. It's sitting in the car, listening to Jack Benny, me, my mom, and my dad. the happiest memories that I have. Or listening to, like you say, the High O' Silver, that sort of a thing, when we listen to some of the Westerns or any of it.
Is your wife still with you?
Oh, yes. Yeah. She's the boss. Yeah. She's here. She's everywhere we are, even if she's not in the room. Yeah. She's the boss. But
I love that.
These are the things. For her and I, my mom loves musicals. So for us, we listen to Gypsy or Carousel in the car. And as a kid, I thought that I was supposed to sound like Ethel Merman, was then later told that is not how one tries to sound. All of these pieces you can go through, but for you to have been involved in so many of them.
Well, everything we're talking about is involved as a listener, as a member of the audience.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All the Gypsies and the Oklahomans.
Yeah, sure.
But even as seeing, like, you know, the name Danny Kaye, when I see that, that's those his movies.
When I was
the music.
Leon Cooperman and I collected records, 78s. Mm-hmm. The 33 and a third, is that what it is?
78 was the old fashioned.
The big one.
And then the long playing were the 33.
Was 33. I was trying to remember that. They were just coming along. We were collecting 78s. And Danny Kaye. I got to try this. I am Anatole Patterson. My small flues make heady news from Fifth Avenue basements to... From Fifth Avenue casements to Orbach's basements. A little bit of straw. I used to remember.
You
got
it.
I'm impressed. It's okay. I'm impressed. Now, oddly, the first TV show, I think, the first TV show that you created from scratch was a dramatic series for Henry Fonda, The Deputy.
Oh, well, my Roland Kibbe.
Yes.
Was he's the one that brought Bud and me into radio and television.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
We were working for him.
Oh, my.
On The Deputy. No.
Yeah.
It was just Simmons and me. It wasn't Bud on The Deputy. Or was he? Is his name
I don't
there?
Think so. I think I
No,
think
he
just
was.
You.
He was doing his own thing. And but he gave me, or I think I told the story before, he wanted me to come to work on the Tennessee Ernie Ford show. Mm-hmm. Wanted Ed and me. Ed didn't think it was the mm-hmm. right thing. I did it alone. That's how we broke up. And Roland Kibbe was the head writer. I was a junior writer. I learned so much from Roland Kibbe. And the other show we were talking about, Roland Kibbe was with Tennessee Ernie Ford. Mm-hmm. He was the head writer with that, too.
Okay. But was that the first time you'd written a serious show, totally serious show, The Deputy?
Yes, and the only time. And the only time.
Did you enjoy the challenge?
Oh, you know what I remember about that? This is the first script.
Yeah.
The young actor who played the
Alan deputy, Case.
Alan Case was, we all thought
That's
was going to be.
Courtesy of Mommy. She liked Alan Case.
Was going to be a big star, and it never happened.
No.
But he was such a winning person or possibility at that time. Anyway, he had a gun store. And this is almost, if not, the opening scene. And a guy comes into the gun store and wants to buy a handgun. Wants his handgun fixed because it's shooting high and to the left or something like that. And Alan Case says, we don't do handguns here, just rifles. And that was the first political, the first social-minded thing I can remember.
Wow, wow. A portent of things to come.
A portent of things to come, yeah.
Just when you thought you weren't going to use the word portent this week.
Yeah, well.
Comes into play.
But I within the last 10 years sometime, I had reason to look for that first episode of mm-hmm. Deputy, and mm-hmm. the scene was what I remembered.
Oh, neat.
Who excited you then and who excites you now? Because again, when looking, the idea that you work with Gene Wilder, or Donald Sutherland or any of these, the best of the best, really. You worked with, whether it was musical, whatever. I didn't realize how talented Jerry Lewis was in terms of the singing and the dancing and the other stuff, because I always saw him do the comedy bits. And it was actually from watching the Andy Williams show. Went back and watched an old episode.
There's a YouTube clip
of Tony Curtis.
No, it's where Jerry Lewis is trying to tell Andy how to perform Moon River. And he's doing this whole dance. And I watched it and I said to my dad, I didn't realize that Jerry could sing like that or dance like that. Even when he's joking, still, he could really do it.
Yeah.
So those sorts of people, Jerry Lewis and Gene Wilder and all, just the best of the best. You know, who excited you then? Who made you excited?
Take a look at One Day at a Time now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Latino version. And
right.
You'll see the best of the best.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
true.
You were saying the lead.
Every time, every utterance from Rita Moreno, boom, lands it's supposed to.
And Justina Machado as well.
Yes.
Well, that's the thing. You were very impressed with her.
Yes, I was.
She's really taken with her.
Yeah.
She's a giant.
Yeah.
Well, I'm still, if there's any secret to my success as a producer or whatever, it is that I walk into a theater or a room or wherever, and I sit down and my feeling is take me.
Right.
I don't sit down, even casting. I don't feel like the judge. I am in that position. I look at the performer and my feeling is take me. And that's the way I feel about it. I almost worship in theaters.
Mm-hmm.
I love live performance so much.
Mm-hmm.
So you are still a great audience.
I think myself an audience, yes.
Mm-hmm. Which is why I think you're a great producer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think sitting in this conversation, I'm as much an audience as I am the guy you're interviewing.
Mm-hmm.
As I, including you.
Aristotle on the couch, shrugging. Yes. We're fans. More than we're anything else, we're fans first.
Well, I'm a fan of life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, God bless you, Norman.
God bless us all.
Yes, mm-hmm. indeed.
And we need it.
yes, we do. Yes, and we deserve it.
And we do earn it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for giving us your time today.
Yeah. And I love the father-daughter thing. I think
thank you so much.
It's great.
Thank you so much.
As a man with five daughters.
Yes.
He's surrounded by women. He's very much, that's why I say my mom is the boss. We're all okay with that.
And on it goes.
Thank you again.
You are welcome.
And Jesse, when people want to find us, where do they find us?
So you are at Leonard Maltin, and I'm at Jesse Maltin on Twitter and on Instagram. And you can go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews and book roundups and all kinds of good stuff.
And that's the way it is, as Mr. Cronkite used to say. We will see you all next week. Bye-bye. Today's episode of Maltin on Movies is brought to you by Legion M, the world's first fan-owned entertainment company. If you love movies as much as we do, why not own a piece of them? Find out more at www.legionm.com.